be with you.
The remnant.
It's hard to say goodbye to that many people that we've been studying with. Yeah. Is anyone new to Bible study today? Are you? Great. Okay. A couple folks. Good? Good. Oh, wonderful.
Thanks here.
Yes. Then we can start. What we've been talking about this week is an interest of mine, a passion of mine, which is how do we think about immigration, migration, crossing boundaries, especially in our context today where we have so many people coming across borders and traveling. And I think on the first day of Bible study, and maybe only a few of you were here, I asked how many people are immigrants? And we got about two or three people. And then I said, how many people are from families of immigrants? Y'all better put your hands up. Right? Anybody not an immigrant to North America? I didn't think so. So if we go back even for Native Americans, there's some point at which they came across the Bering Strait. Somewhere. So one of the things that I wanted to try and think about with everyone is what it means to be an immigrant of a particular generation. I don't know, I think I'm about eight generations of down. I'm from the East Coast, we go way back. Some of you are first generation, some of you are third generation, second generation, fourth, fifth generation, maybe back as far as eight, ten generations. So we all have an immigrant story. Some of us are more deeply connected to that heritage than others, especially if your parents were the first to arrive, or your grandparents, and your parents carry that memory of growing up and being the bilingual child and negotiating all of those things. So this is what I mean about immigrant and what I mean about migration is crossing borders, crossing boundaries. And one very simple example I think I gave earlier in the week is if you're sitting down and you reach across the aisle to shake somebody's hand, no, we don't know each other.
Right.
So we have just crossed a boundary, if you will, extended an arm, extended a hand to become known to each other in a way. Right. So you can start out as strangers and cross a boundary, whether it's just as simple as offering a hand across an armchair, the arm of a chair, or whether it is walking across the street to meet your new neighbors, or whether it is, some of you have been to Turkey, getting on a plane and going and crossing the ocean and walking into a place of a different faith. So there are many ways to cross boundaries. We do it all the time. And I wanted to think about what an ethic of border crossing would be and how that might open us up to meeting the other. And this has a very theological undergirding. And so I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself for some folks, but the theological undergirding is that God is completely other than us. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. God is not us, therefore God is other than us. And in order to encounter God, then somebody has to cross a boundary. God takes on flesh, crosses the divine and human boundary, becomes part of creation, and comes to meet us. Likewise, we too often have to set our minds in the right way, and because we're human, we have limitations, cross the threshold into worship, or cross the threshold out of worship and be in the wilderness and come close to God that way. So we're always, when we're relating to God, encountering another in some way. So my hypothesis, if you will, hopefully a theological hypothesis, is that when we extend the arm across the chair railing or whatever it is, or go to another country or invite someone into our homes or into our churches, they're crossing a boundary. What we're doing in that moment is having an encounter with an other. And that can prepare us, if we get used to doing that, going out of our comfort zone, crossing the street, crossing a boundary, that prepares us for encounters with God as other. Now, this is not to say that God is not ever present with us. But because we're human and we have limitations, it's very hard to be aware of God ever present with us all the time. We live in a world of boundaries. You know, here's a boundary. I can't go any further. I'm stuck here. I have to go around or over or something. God meets us in these places where we have limits and boundaries. So what I thought is this ethic of crossing boundaries, stretching ourselves, if you will, going outside of our comfort zone, can be a practice that we cultivate as a way of meeting God, or meeting that of God in another. Quakers would say meeting that of Christ in the other person, or looking for that of Christ in another person. So let's look at Genesis 1 today, thinking about this migration, crossing boundaries, and I want to look at the way God sets up the boundaries of creation from the very beginning in our story, in our Christian story, in our Jewish Christian heritage. And a couple of the things I want to focus on are chaos and order, the role of Sabbath, and the rhythm that's established in this piece. I'm going to have to watch time. We're going to try and do this in three ways. We'll start out looking at the boundaries that God sets up and the order that God sets up. So let's read a little bit. I could have one more light. You all can't see, can you?
I can't see.
There we go. That didn't help at all, but it helps me. If I stand under it, I can see. So let me read to you a little bit of Genesis 1. Oh.
No, these are over there for the track lights.
Oh, I think they've got the... Okay, we'll figure it out. Let me read you a little bit of Genesis 1. If you don't have a Bible, that's fine. If you want to follow along, great. If you would like to just listen... I think we're okay. Yeah. If you want to just listen, they keep going on and on.
I just should turn this.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Everybody set? Oh, see that? That? She's opening the window. What a good thought. Natural light. Who knew? Listen to the rhythm here, and listen for what God is doing. Okay. So what God is doing, and how the rhythm of the language goes. In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was formless, void, and a darkness, the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness God called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. Marty was doing some of that rhythm today as we reviewed the week, if you were here for the morning piece. Yeah. How is God creating?
Speaks.
Speech, yeah. This is very different from Genesis 2, where God creates sort of like we create out of mud and bone and hands. But here, there's no sense of a body of God. There's no anthropomorphizing. It's just a voice, right? And that speech that God is bringing things into being. Let there be light. And there was. And then what? God saw. So we have a mouth and eyes, or at least a speaking and a seeing kind of thing. And then what does God do?
Separate.
Right? So, speak something into being, see it, it's good, and divide it, night, day, or light, darkness. We haven't gotten to night, day yet. Okay. Let me read a little bit more. And God said, let there be a dome in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters. So God made the dome and separated the waters that were under the dome from the waters that were above the dome. And it was so. God called the dome sky, and there was evening and there was morning, a second day. And God said, let the waters under the sky be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. God called the dry land earth, and the waters that were gathered together God called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the earth put forth vegetation, plants yielding seed and fruit trees of every kind on earth that bear fruit with the seed in it. And it was so. The earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed of every kind, trees of every kind bearing fruit with the seed in it. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the third day. What do you notice? What do you hear in the rhythm of this?
God saw that it was good.
Okay. Repetition? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are certain phrases that are repeating within little paragraphs and then across paragraphs, right? Across different things that are created. Yeah.
The first five verses almost sound like a song, but not after that.
Uh-huh. It gets a little more detailed after that. Yeah.
It was really kind of a liturgical worship rhythm.
Mm-hmm. You can hear that, can't
you? Yes, you can.
Especially,
God said and there was.
Okay. Yeah. God said and there was. It's almost that call and response that some of us were talking about in worship. Yeah.
So,
God said, it happened. Yeah.
It's also a parallel structure.
You want to say more about that?
So you have. I mean, grammatically, you have the. The parallelism of, and God said, then you have the quotation, then you have the what God spoke.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this in parallel. It's the same all the way through.
Parallel repetition all the way through. Right. So what's changing within the repeated structure? So the repeated structure is God said, God saw, right?
God is dividing.
God divided. Right? So that's the structure. What changes between that structure?
What's being created?
The object of God's creative abilities. Yeah. Yeah. So what do we start with? Light and dark. And then what do we go to?
Water and sky.
Water and sky. Uh-huh. And for them, like, for those of you who have been here a couple days, the sky was made of water, right? So you have big water. This is how the ancients imagined the world. And God takes a dome, and some dome, we don't know what, rakia, we don't know what that is in Hebrew, puts it in the middle of the water and raises part of it up and pushes part of it down. So there's sort of a bathysphere in the middle now. And then you have water above and water below, which makes perfect sense, does it not? Because the rain's coming through, coming from above, there's something that holds the rest of the water back, but sometimes it leaks through. Okay. So this is the way the ancient is imagining the world that God is creating. And then the water is below. Okay, so we have light, dark,
water.
Then what?
Dry
land. Dry land.
Ground and seas.
Ground and seas.
Plants.
And then plants. The note in I use the HarperCollins Study Bible for NRSV, and my note, which many of you probably have observed at one time, or this will sound familiar to you, is that the rhythm of the things that are created follows evolution. Right?
Sort of.
Work with me here.
Yeah.
Right? So first, it's the water, right? And then we move to plant life, which technically should have been in the water in, in evolution, but it's growing on the land. And then we're going to move to things that swim. Right? What things swim? And?
Amphibians.
And?
Birds.
Birds swim. Exactly right. You didn't know that birds swim, did you?
Yes.
But have you seen a stingray? Swimming, flying in the water? And you've seen owls? Up here we get to see owls flying in the sky waters? Right? So it's interesting that in this story, in the Hebrew, as some of you have pointed out, the language for birds and fish is the same, because they're both doing what they do in water, essentially. Right? Isn't that interesting? Different conception of the world. So we are not in Kansas anymore. We have crossed over into the ancient mindset, and we are in a different way of perceiving what's around us. So you're right, it's not exactly evolution, but it seems to be the small things growing into the larger, more complex things in a general way. All right. And God said, let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years, and let them be lights in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth. And it was so. God made the two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night, and the stars. God set them in the dome of the sky to give light upon the earth. So rule over the day and rule over the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. Any other kind of creation happening than what we've noted? There are things being spoken into being and things being divided. Any other form of creating happening?
Adding.
Sorry?
Adding.
Adding. How so?
Well, God made the two great lights. So the great lights, whereas he's divided the land or the mass into land and sea, now he's adding other things.
Okay, God said, let there be lights in the dome of the sky. In verse 14. And then the great light in the...
It's creating time. Time and seasons.
Time and seasons. Yeah. Yeah. And...
It's actually dividing them.
Dividing what?
Time.
Marking time, dividing weeks, dividing months, dividing years by the placement of the stars and
things. Well, in a sense, it began with the first day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you're going to try to
exactly
push it
right.
That way.
Exactly right, because yeah. Day one, right?
I have a real problem with trying to fit it all into a scientific understanding, and that's part
well,
of
you can't.
I know, but that's part of the problem with a lot of people in our
yes.
country today.
Yeah.
Including Kansas.
Hopefully not all of Kansas. Yeah, let me say a word about that and then we can set it aside, I hope. My sense is that today we have reduced the understanding of what truth is to mean scientific truth. And that's it. It's only true if you can prove it. Right? But we've forgotten about emotional truth. How do you know that she loves you? How does a mother know a child loves her? That's emotional truth. You can't prove that. You can't do a chemical experiment and like salt it down and take a reading of it. So we've sort of negated when we raise up science to the level of the only kind of truth there is. What happens is we forget emotional truth, we forget relational truth, we forget a bunch of other kinds of truth. Hold on, I'll get to God. And I think what happens is because we have elevated scientific truth to be the kind of truth, then we're stuck having to prove that God exists. And we're stuck having to prove, according to science, that creation happened, you know, and this and that, and the Bible is true according to chemical reactions and everything I can prove. But what we've forgotten, and what I think Christians can claim, is that science is one kind of truth. Emotions are another kind of truth. Relationships, another kind of truth. Touch, another kind of truth. Experience, another kind of truth. And you can't prove God. You can put God in the other truth categories, but you can't put God in the science category. Because God is beyond that, isn't it? It can't measure God. Science is a human category, and you can't measure God with human categories. So part of the issue there, right, is Christians get caught up in having to prove God or prove the scriptures according to what they've, what society has decided is the one kind of truth anymore. And so one thing I think we can remember and affirm for ourselves is that there's a scriptural truth. And it doesn't have to follow scientific categories to be true.
Can we call that conceptual truth?
Sure.
Truth of meaning.
Truth of meaning, truth of storytelling, truth of tradition handed down.
Yeah. A lot of things have happened when we weren't looking in science, cosmology and quantum physics. Mm-hmm. There are people now like John Polkinghorne, who is in fact a Anglican
priest.
What is the word? Theologian.
Yeah.
And at the same time, he's a quantum physicist, mm-hmm. and he writes books where he compares back and forth between. And just to be very brief about it, quantum physics on the cutting edge, which is anybody who says they understand it is kidding themselves, according to the experts. But those who are pursuing it are finding out that practically anything that has been imagined or projected or thought about God fits in perfectly with what they observe there.
It depends on which scientist.
There's at some level at which they are conceptualizing where things come down to the mind and will of God. They just don't call it God.
Well, sure, and I don't want to get into the scientific theme, but it science is hypothetical in many times, and proofs and all of that. So you can get people on all sides of the argument.
And they claim no proof. They do not say they're proving anything. They say it's entirely conceptual and speculative.
Well, when you get into that kind of physics, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm talking about basic chemistry experiments, right, and other things.
Well, as you talk about truth, I mean, the book of Genesis is all about theological truth.
Yeah.
And the book of Genesis in no way is intended as any kind of a scientific treatise explaining how things happen. Instead, it's a theological book that talks about who God is and who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And what the purpose of God's intentions are in, mm-hmm. with my life or with life,
mm-hmm.
and this, the Genesis stories were originally part of the gallery.
Don't take away my steam. I'm trying to build to something. If you go teach in the class, you're going to undermine what I'm doing.
I shall say. Thank you. Sorry.
Last comment.
Where would you place the fuzzy truth of?
I don't know that it's a fuzzy truth. It's a way. It's an experience we have in the world.
Experience.
Intuition. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Totally unprovable.
Well, of course. Yeah. It's another sense. So let me bring us back to the text for a second. Make sure I leave enough time. We have the speaking things into being and dividing things. Yeah. And very good. What you noticed was that the rhythms that are part of this text are setting up time in a way. And the rhythm actually, day one, day two, day three, within the text, then, are these boundaries of time, or even liturgical seasons, are contained as part of the text. Let me read one. We're going to skip a little bit and go to my favorite part. And I'm going to do my own translation here on verse 26 from the Hebrew. And just so we can hear it in a different way, and maybe I know many of you have studied Genesis, so just stay with us for a second. In verse 26 of chapter 1, God said, "Let us make humankind in our image." All right? And my little C down here says Adam. So it's Adam in Hebrew, lowercase. My translation for that is earthling. It's not male, it's not female. It is a Adam from Adama. It is a creature from the earth. Okay? So let's use earthling here and see what happens. So God created earthling in God's image. In the image of God, God created it. It shouldn't be a them, it's not plural. Right? And your little notes should tell you that. It's him because that's the grammatical gender. But it could just as well be it. Okay? So God created earthling in God's image. In the image of God, God created earthling. Male and female, God created them. What just happened?
Divided.
Yeah.
And set up a boundary.
So, but what's so fascinating to me is that God creates earthling, picture like a gingerbread person, you know? They sort of have no anatomical commitment yet. And you divide them in half, or divide them somehow. Maybe God didn't do things by halves. But one half is called male, and one half is called female. Very interesting. Because this is continuous with the way God is doing things, dividing the waters, dividing the light from the darkness, dividing the... and setting a boundary between the two, right? So in that way, this earthling, this humanoid person, is just like the rest of creation, except in the image of God. Now, when is the earthling in the image of God? After it's divided or before?
Before.
Yeah. So that's interesting too. As much as we need our feminist movements and our, you know, strong male solution movements and whatever we come up with, we can't do without each other in our community. And I think in terms of community. I know today we think in terms of individuals and partners for life. Forget that. Let's talk about community. In our community, you can't have a full representation unless you have both the men and the women represented. So many people do that in different ways. You know, Quakers, early on, the women had their meeting over there, the men had their meeting over here. And then they came back together to eat the meal. There's many ways of doing that, being together. But I just, this is one of my favorite parts. And you'll notice it's very different from Genesis 2 and 3. But that God created the earthling and then divided it. God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply." And then it goes on. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Chapter 2 merges here. So, thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all their multitude. And on the seventh day, God finished the work that God had done, and God rested on the seventh day from all the work that God had done. So God blessed the seventh day, and hallowed it, made it holy, because on it God rested from all the work that God had done in creation. So, tell me about chaos and order here. Let's think a little bit about chaos and order in this story. Where does Genesis start out?
Chaos.
Yeah, the tohu vabohu, the mixing and mulling of things all over the place. Yeah. And where does the order come from?
God's word.
God's spoken word.
And he
he separates or classifies.
And the setting up of boundaries. Yeah. And classification and the naming.
God was present even in chaos and the wind of the Spirit.
Yep. There before it and after it. On both sides of the chaos and the order.
The order of the week. The rhythm of
and the rhythm of the week. Yeah. Yep. Now tell me about Sabbath. What role does Sabbath play here?
It's part of creation.
Part of creation, part of the order of creation. Part of the life of God. Which seems to be, I mean, the life of God seems to be what is structuring the life of creation in some ways. Right? It's God's speech that's coming out and ordering things. Then God's participation in the ordering of things. And then everything sort of rests on the seventh day.
What is holy about the seventh day?
Blessed and hallowed.
Yeah, the holy
means set aside.
Means set aside.
Right.
Yeah, it's like ordained, right? You don't get some special status when you're ordained. You're just set aside to a particular role. So the seventh day is set aside for a particular resting. Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. Good. So we have boundaries. We have order. And this is all at the level of the story, looking at what God is doing. Now, if we shift a little bit, this story is actually more recent than Genesis 2 and 3. Genesis 2 and 3 is older. The Adam and Eve story, that's a lot older. This story was written at the time of priests and by the priestly group of people that were organizing things. And so for the priests, this was the liturgy. This is their daily order. This is how they understand their work in the world in relationship to the creation of God. Now, when I say it's priestly, can you feel that in the rhythm of it? It's very exact, it's methodical, it's rhythmic, it's repetitive, it's... you know, there's a transformation over the time. There's a ordering. You go from cosmic things to small living things to greater living things. And it's this, it's like a librarian wrote it. It's very well organized. But the priests were the librarians and the scribes of the time. So they're the ones that have put this together. So my question to you, one of the things we've been thinking about is how liturgical order, how liturgy, the way we do things, organizes chaos. So here you have not only, as you've noted, God creating creation, but God creating an order to things, which is so helpful. I don't know about you, but I don't like chaos. Sociologist Peter Berger says that human beings don't most fear death, they most fear chaos. Mm-hmm. That is the enemy of our minds, our souls, our culture, chaos. We always want to fix it. And so if you think about times of trauma that people experience, that's a wound in them that is chaotic, and they try and make sense of it to give it some kind of order. So here, what the priests are doing is ordering their lives and seeing how God has roped in chaos, if you will, and pulled it all together.
Well, stop me, because I mean...
No, go ahead. I was going to transition somewhere else.
Well, no, just that there's a dark underbelly to this, too.
Tell us.
Well, that this was also the priest in Babylon who was freaked out about mixing. And he's the one that keeps repeating each according to their own kind. And so he's obsessed with separation.
Yeah.
And so while it's also sweet and nice, there's also this piece where he is...
The priest is writing this. All right, so let's follow that track for a second. The priest is writing this in the Babylonian exile. And the priest is very concerned that the people of God follow an order. Why?
So they're not contaminated by the pagan culture.
Even before contamination.
That's their story.
That they don't lose their story.
Why do they create an order for the people in exile in Babylon?
So they forget God. So they don't forget the identity.
Have you ever been exiled?
Identity, assimilation.
Chaos. Chaos. This is a tourniquet for chaos. And the priests of Israel in Babylon in exile is obsessed with order and boundaries because there aren't any. They've been marched as prisoners of war from all the way over there to all the way over here. There's nothing left of where they came from. So the first thing you do is you round the wagons, you rally the troops, you figure out, okay, this is going to be our identity, and you hold firm to that. Right? So it's really, even though it's a dark underbelly, it's very human. Right? When we feel threatened, we draw lines. This is the immigration debate. People feel threatened when an other is coming into the country, taking jobs, not paying taxes. Well, if you actually go investigate, are they taking jobs? Are they not paying taxes? I met a woman here who is an auditor. I mean, she's a tax person, does taxes. You know how many undocumented immigrants pay their taxes to her? They come to her for help to pay their taxes?
Yeah, probably a lot.
And they're bringing her 1099 forms? Because even though they're working on a, you know, a social security card that's not work, you know, it's somebody else's number or it's a made-up number, their employer is not paying the social security. So when they pay their taxes off the 1099 form, they are paying the employer side and their side. And they're doing the equivalent of full-time work. So anytime you hear somebody say they're not paying taxes, that may be true for many people, but there are some folks who are paying their taxes because they want to follow all the laws that they can, even though they've broken a big one coming into the country. There's no other way. So that is, there's no other way to get in the country legally to assist their economic situation. There's a lot that you kind of have to go back and back and back to talk about that. So organizing, creating boundaries when there's a threat and when there's fear. And I want to show a little clip, and hopefully, maybe you'll give me to 3:35.
Sure.
Okay. Because we started a little bit late. So I want to show just about a 10-minute clip. And again, this is a group of immigrants, a group of migrants, actually. Some are Mixteca. Some are Mexican. Mixteca means that they are native Mexicans. That is, they are native to that area before it was Mexico, and they don't speak Spanish, some of them. So they Mixteca sounds like Aztec. They're descendants of the original people that were there. And they have migrated into San Diego area, into a canyon called Deer Canyon. And they're living there in the canyon while they work. And they work in construction, they work in agriculture, and they work in gardening. All right, so those are the main occupations. What you'll see are children and women alongside them. So whole families are living in this situation. And what I would like us to think about is, what is the role of liturgy for them, liturgical order, setting boundaries, and how do they negotiate those boundaries? And how do they negotiate the chaos and the order that God sets out for humankind? Okay. So let me get this out of the way. And I'll flip off a couple lights. Yeah, you all that were so helpful. You found all the light switches. We'll get them and go back. Oh, it's skipping. That's not good. So this is the canyon where they live.
Are they families or men?
Yes, men.
Men and then some families.
Some families.
This was started by three women around 1985 or 86. They noticed that there were men out there and thought that they should bring them something to eat before they started their work. So these three women would prepare a pot of beans, tacos, and some meats. They came to me and said, "These men are asking for mass." I was unaware of their existence out there. I just was not aware. I said, "Yeah, okay, I'll go out. So we met for Mass at 6 behind a bush. That's where we planted the little plaque of Our Lady Guadalupe and the cross that were out there. But the landowners kicked us off after some months. And so the men found what is known now as the shrine, or the chapel. And we moved down there about 18, 19 years ago. They built the shrine. They took the plaque of Our Lady Guadalupe and put it in the shrine itself, as well as the cross. They put in benches, and we found some tables and so forth.
Take that. talked to one of the other volunteers, and they think that soon this is probably going to be taken away.
They've been threatening that for a long time. I don't
call here. Well, because there's so many more houses. I mean, it seems to be closing in, you know?
So I was in church one day, and my typical, you know, I was taking a class, and I'm thinking about what I was going to write for my class, and all of a sudden, you know, he just started speaking about the guys that were out here and our responsibility to them. He was recruiting people. He was looking straight at me. So I thought, are you looking at me? Don't be looking at me, you know. So finally, I went home and I thought, it was a nagging feeling. I thought, okay, next week I'm coming out. Boy, that was quite a while back.
Also is a saint. He's an extraordinary man of faith who doesn't speak Spanish. And so the efforts to communicate with him, we have to have an interpreter. And he is one of the men that Cristoria and others prepared for his first communion and his confirmation. And there seems to have been a very deep spiritual awakening in him. Which is only, I say, is the act of God, the Holy Spirit, involved. He is an extraordinary Eucharistic minister, and he tends to that with such faith. It's extraordinary. It's beyond language. We're dealing in the whole relationship with God, which is beyond language. And Generoso, for me, is a real sign of that as a reality.
Por mi parte, ya, sí. Ya hagan, tiene que poner el día, sí. Bueno, yo creo que si quiero llegar bien, que
yo no sé hablar bien español. A mí me gusta escuchar la palabra de Dios. A mí me gusta saber quién es Dios. Lo que mi madre me enseñó sobre los mandamientos de Dios. Es bonito, la palabra de Dios es muy grande. Hay muchos que critican a Dios. Yo me hago a un lado y me voy caminando. Dios me va a cuidar. Ni mi mamá ni mi papá, el único que me va a cuidar es Dios.
Trabajarás y en ellos harás todos tus quehaceres. Pero el día séptimo es día de descanso dedicado al Señor tu Dios. No harás en el trabajo alguno, ni tú, ni tu hijo, ni tu hija, ni tu esclavo, ni tu esclava, ni tus animales, ni el forastero que viva contigo, porque el seis días hizo el Señor el cielo, la tierra, el mar, cuanto hay en ellos, pero el séptimo descansó. Por eso bendijo el Señor el sábado y lo santificó.
So I'm going to stop there. How is the Sabbath working for them?
It's very real.
Very real. These words sound different, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
When you hear them in this context. Yeah. What else did you notice about order and chaos, Sabbath and what was my other one? And rhythm.
It seemed important that they brought order to their space.
Yeah.
Well, and along with the order came community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very gently swept out all the leaves and benches.
Mm-hmm. Just before you stopped this, it looked like there was a policeman back there.
In the group?
Yeah.
I didn't notice that, but we can rewind and look at it again.
There was?
Yeah, maybe a park guard or something. They have allies in the community. It gets more and more tense, but they built all of this.
Who owns the land?
It's public land.
Mm-hmm.
Park land, I think, by the canyon. But what's happening? Yeah, I don't know what the official category is, but the land is being built on, and this canyon is being encroached upon.
Mm-hmm.
And so more and more homes are coming close to where these men are going to work and where they're washing their clothes and that kind of thing. Yeah.
This was 2006, 2006.
Yeah, that's what it said.
That was the date on the missal.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he published this in 2007. He was filming for a year. This is Juan Carlos Frey, who does a lot of really unique filming.
Well, the nation's already getting very agitated about the illegals.
Yeah, it's true.
I think the liturgy gives life in the midst of uncertain life.
Uh-huh. That's what I wondered. I mean, when you saw the kinds of places they're living in,
mm-hmm.
They basically collect tarps, plastic tarps, you know, maybe after they're finished putting the clippings from the lawn and carrying them to the trash, there's an old tarp that has holes in it, you can't use it for lawn work anymore, and they bring those back or they find them in the dump or find them by the side of the road, and that's what creates their, keeps them dry. And you saw one guy had a little electric stove, very simple. A lot is recycled garbage, you know. So you're using jugs of water instead of buying a watering can to wash your clothes. It seems to me that in that chaos of life, you know, you do get very orderly. You do sweep away the leaves, even though you're in the middle of the forest. You do create a chapel for yourself that, as you all noted, creates community around that. Yes, sir?
There's dignity.
There's a lot of dignity here, isn't
yeah,
there?
They're setting themselves.
Yeah, yeah. And notice how the boundaries do that. When you set up a space, you create a place for yourself within it, which can give you dignity. They have roles to play here.
It's mostly men. Is that just because of what he felt?
Y'all saw some women, and there's little girls in here and little boys. So there are some families here. It's mostly men because it's mostly men that come to do the hard labor, construction, and gardening.
And are they sending all their money back then? Because otherwise they could.
Yes, voluntarily.
Mm-hmm. So it's all going back. We had someone up here.
For me,
the idea of liturgy also would be a constant. It's one thing that wouldn't change in their life from back home to here also. So therefore, that gives me some security in my new space that's like my old space.
Mm-hmm. And notice, Hemet also means generous. So this Mystica man, is his name is generous. And he seems to have encountered faith here. And has drawn more and more into a spirituality and the rhythm of the chapel and the community while he's here. When we're finished, I'll play the rest of the film if some folks want to stay and see it. But he really plays a unique role in terms of how he's helping the priests out and how he's relating to everything. Yeah, let's go back here and then we'll come back.
There's one thing that strikes me that might be sort of a theology of accompaniment, in the sense that the Anglos that are working with these people, the priests, etc., they've met them where they are, and they have incorporated, for example, the Virgin de Guadalupe. They've not sort of depreciated that saint, which is so important in their culture. So that's something to us about borders.
Very nice.
That we accompany, and if you accompany, it's like Jesus on the road to Emmaus.
Yeah.
If you accompany, then that means that you adopt and adapt to someone else's culture.
Mm-hmm. And the blonde woman who was in school and is now a sacristan or helps out with the mass, she was saying, Guadalupe has become my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sure she didn't have a place for Guadalupe before she encountered these folks. But she in the accompaniment, she's learned from them, and she uses that language, which is what accompaniment should be. It's not, I'm going to walk with you to help you.
Right.
You find out very quickly that actually you're the one being helped. And there's a wisdom.
If you take the immigrant story even back farther, the conquistadors in the Extremadura of Spain from Guadalupe brought that story to Mexico and crossed huge borders to do that. And then the natives crossed the border to accept the story.
Yeah. Yeah, Guadalupe is a migrant. That's very nice. And she's not only migrant, she's bicultural. She is Guadalupe, who appears to the people on the goddess of Tepeyac, right? So where the shrine where the Aztec goddess was, that's where Guadalupe appears, and that's she's going to relate to the people through their former gods, which is a very interesting way of doing things. Yeah,
I'm struck by the El Camino del Real, the fact that the Spanish actually colonized, use that word in it, pejorative kind of way, that area.
Yeah.
And now the same people are being excluded or denigrated.
From this place that was theirs originally, before the border crossed them.
Yeah. And also, not speaking the language, I think the liturgy, with all its repetition, gives him access into that in a different kind of way. I also see the blend of the masculine and feminine, both, even though they're mostly men, there's, you know, the
women in leadership, there's,
and even the way it's done, and then the delight in the priest that you can see, as he's giving, he's receiving so much himself.
Yeah, he's a very profound person. So let me say this. If you need to go, we'll wrap up the Bible study part here. If you'd like to stay, we started at the beginning, so I'll just play the rest. There's only about 20 minutes left. It's only a half-hour little documentary. Love to see it. What happens is this shrine is threatened, for those of you who have to leave, and they have to take it all apart.
Oh.
So it's been up there for 10 years, 20 years.
Oh.
and they have to take it apart, and then they become migrants with their shrine becomes a migrant. Mm-hmm. And they have to find a place, a home for it. So at least you get the story, those of you who have time. Yeah.
And what is the hierarchy doing with the priest?
You know, they don't talk about the hierarchy with the priest. He's got his own parish. And then he comes and does this mass as well. So it's probably within his local parish order. And obviously people from his parish are coming. But it's not a, I think it's an additional ministry that he's sort of taken on. But they don't talk about that. Yeah.
I'm just, since we're starting to break up, but
yeah.
How do you keep the theology of order and separation from becoming apartheid?
A too fixed boundary.
Yeah, because you do have the very fixed and orderly Genesis 1, but Genesis 2 is just kind of quee-ha,
yeah.
And you don't get boundaries until sin.
Yeah.
When God has to fix a boundary too.
For me, the short answer is humility. We know that it was priests in Babylon, as you're saying, in a situation of chaos, who recorded Genesis 1. And it fed the need of that time. But Genesis 1 is God creating the boundaries. And God is creating the boundaries to create a livable environment. So the humility comes in when people say to me, oh no, you have to have the Bantustans, you have to have the apartheid, you have to have, we can't live side by side with you. What are you talking about? Gated communities, that's the way to go. Really?
But I've heard people also say
is that
this is
the
this
boundary
is the way God wants it.
Well, is that the boundary God set up? And they say, yes, that's the way God wants it. How do you know? Go. Well, it's in the Bible.
Who made you God?
Right. So for me, it won't change that person's mind ever. But for me, it's a question of humility. I get this from Calvin, right? I don't know God's mind. And as soon as I claim to know God's mind, I'm wrong.
Yeah.
And God is always breaking the boundaries.
Jesus constantly is breaking boundaries. He's always
going to get there. Just kidding. Yes, exactly. Yeah, the Gerasene demoniac, the Syrophoenician woman. Jesus is going every which direction across the boundaries. And the gospel writers are breaking boundaries. So I don't think I'm able to convince the people that do make that argument. But when you come up against that argument, when I come up against that argument, for me it becomes a question of, well, do I know the mind of God? No.
I've heard it taken out to the degree where it becomes part of the natural order.
Yeah.
This is the way, you know, God intended us each according to their own kind, blah,
exactly.
Blah, blah. There's a danger point where we have to be careful.
Absolutely.
That we couldn't actually flip around and start supporting the very thing that we're trying to break down.
Well, and what I mean by taking on this, what I'm calling an ethic of migration or an ethic of border crossing is that most of the borders we encounter in our lives are our own devices. They're human borders. God is a disrespecter of human borders. Now, there's one woman who didn't like me saying it. God is a disrespecter. But God disrespects human borders. They do not exist for God. And God can move across those with ease because they don't exist. I mean, we see them, but God doesn't see them. And yet we have that God calling us continually, get beyond yourself and your own limits and go help the person who's more vulnerable than you. That's the call over and over and over. Not set up a gated community so they can't come in. Mm-hmm. But if you're going to live in a gated community, make sure you cross that gate as often as possible and see what it's like living on the other side. There's a reality. If you have small children, there are things you need to do in life to keep living. But God always calls all of that into question, and makes us at least have to think about it over and over and over. So.
The thing that I noticed here is if this is like our community, we have small colonies of homeless people.
Yeah.
And this, I assume, is that. And that chapel is their home, their touchstone of constancy.
where they're accepted, they can care for it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
They can gather.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Good thinking. Let me hit play, and then if y'all want to sit around and think some more, you can.